You're listening to highlights from One Planet Podcast interview with Richard Black, author and director of policy and strategy at Ember Think Tank. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
So the first piece that I'd like to read for you is something that at first sight is tangential to the world of energy and yet is absolutely core to understanding how the economics are changing and therefore why the future is what it is. In 1936, Wright published his first academic paper in the Journal of the Aeronautical Sciences. The contents are as functional as the title, Factors Affecting the Cost of Airplanes. In it, he lays out his key finding. When the volume of production doubles, the cost comes down. Double it again, and the cost comes down again. So, production at volume brings the unit cost down. A lower cost means more demand. More people buying the planes increases the production volume. The price falls further. People buy even more. And this is not just theory. Analysts have plotted the sales volumes and costs of washing machines, mobile phones, cars, dishwashers, and many other items. They've looked at both national and global markets. Whatever and wherever it is, it seems that as standard, the combination of a new desirable mass-produced product and a free competitive market leads to an exponential growth in sales accompanied by a symbiotic fall in the cost. So as I said, Mia, this may not immediately seem to belong to the world of energy, but actually it holds the secret to everything. And the fact is you've got a lot of industrial muscle and political muscle now coming behind clean energy, especially from China, which is, you know, the leading country deploying wind energy, deploying solar, the leading manufacturer and user of electric vehicles by miles. And they've set out industrial policies and all kinds of other policies for, well, at least a decade now in pursuit of that aim. I was wondering, you know, what do we actually need in the world, right? Because we don't need petrol and we don't need coal. We need energy to power various things. In a competitive market, there's lots of innovation going on in terms of battery design, in terms of construction, new materials coming in for batteries. So that's your first two, that's your renewable generation and your battery storage. Electric vehicles will be the main method of transportation, heating and cooling, which is a big demand for energy. We can use heat pumps, which are super efficient, running on electricity. So with that, you've got electricity covered. You can't probably do all of industry with this four-prong prescription. So you need a fifth prong, and the fifth prong is going to be hydrogen. The idea that the world will be running on a hydrogen economy is just wrong. It's far more efficient to do things with electricity if you can, but those few things which you can't use electricity, probably hydrogen made from renewable electricity by splitting water into oxygen and hydrogen, that will probably be the fifth prong. The oil and gas companies, they go through phases of promoting themselves as sort of green and players in the energy transition. And then they go back in the other direction as well. Harry Bellin helped me a bit with the book and has contributed many ideas down the years. His view, and it's one I share, is that the oil and gas companies actually can't really contribute meaningfully to the clean energy transition because currently they return pretty high amounts of money to their shareholders. So if you take things like subsidies, and they could be consumption or production subsidies, it's less than a trillion. But then if you add in the costs of climate change and other damages which are done by using the fossil fuels, we come up to this figure of 5 trillion. And actually in the last few years, it's been more than that. It's been up to 6 and 7 trillion as well. So if you compare it, for example, with the amount that the governments of the West are supposed to supply each year in climate finance, that's 100 billion. So that's about 1/50 of the amount that we're actually subsidizing the fossil fuel industry, which is the major cause of the problem. Yes, I mean, sometimes you can actually change what you do yourself. And I know that each individual action has a very, very minor impact on emissions, but sometimes you can make choices. And it seems that in Europe, the number of people who are doing these things is increasing. Why this was happening? Is it because of concern over climate change? Did they want to get ahead of the game? Was it some kind of response to Putin's attempt to subjugate Ukraine? Don't know. But it does seem, at least in Europe, more people are making these kinds of decisions for themselves. The idea that, for example, wind and solar are expensive, there will be some people that still hold that view, but it's, you know, 5 or 6 years out of date. Things move on. So just engaging in conversation with people that maybe don't quite see where we're at is just a useful thing to do and quite easy to do. There's also something about just democratizing, I think, because if you think about it, oil and gas, they're almost perfect product for oligarchs. Basically, you can make an enormous amount of money quite quickly. And once you've done that, once you own the means of production, the people need oil and gas. It has to arrive every day, and coal as well. So it's totally a seller's market. Whereas by contrast, once you've got your solar panels installed, they produce electricity for you, don't you buy anything else. So it's far less easy for oligarchs and despots to make a killing off fossil fuels. There's something about this democratization argument that I find quite compelling. In a world running on clean energy, with those five things that I described earlier running the energy system, there's no way that Vladimir Putin could have mounted his assaults on Ukraine. This is a report that I was fortunate enough to take part in writing a couple of years ago, courtesy of the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. The report's out there, available for download. It's called Environment of Peace. And it's, I think, a landmark report linking environmental destruction to conflict risk through all kinds of mechanisms and linking peace building and environmental restoration. And the links, some of them are quite obvious and others are a little bit more subtle. There are short-term things and there are long-term things. And there's a role for international institutions as well as national governments. So in the short term, let's put a sticking plaster on the issue. The main recommendations that come out of the report are, for example, environmental peace building, where you try and tackle an environmental issue alongside conflict resolution, is something that could be used a lot more. And United Nations agencies and other organizations can really take this on board and build this into all of their operation. So that's some of the short-term stuff. But the longer-term stuff, the number one thing is to just get off fossil fuels, because all the while we're using fossil fuels, we're going to be chucking carbon dioxide into the air and causing climate change to progress further. And with climate change, you've got the impacts that you kind of know about that are fairly predictable. Once you get to a certain level of climate change, once you get beyond about 2-ish degrees, it's just really hard to predict because you've got nothing to calibrate it against. You're not sure that what your computer models are chucking out is sensible or not. So you've got these known risks and then you've got these unknown risks as well. And the only feasible way to reduce that long-term risk is by stopping burning fossil fuels. Simple as that. In the UK, while I was running the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit since 2014, we saw the Conservative Party, which was in power for the whole time I was running the organisation, really embrace clean energy. Conservatives were at least as far advanced on this as Labour. Then, obviously, there have been a couple of years of what one can only politely describe as turmoil in the government. I think what we saw was a certain element of the Conservative Party basically trying to use clean energy and climate change as a wedge issue. They were trying to use it along with everything that they described as woke to create a sort of difference between them. And so that's the reason why Labour coming into power is potentially very progressive for the UK. All the while we're in the fossil fuel world, the ultimate prices are set by the fossil fuel companies. The major oil and gas companies globally, OPEC, is a cartel. They set what the oil price will be, and everyone who needs an oil product basically has to pay it. If you can afford to make the upfront investments, you equip yourself with, you know, the solar panel, the battery, the heat pump, the electric vehicle. Now, if you equip yourself, for example, with a solar panel, with a heat pump, with a storage battery, and with an electric vehicle, you don't need to be connected to the electricity grid. You don't need the big corporations to supply you with oil and gas and heating oil or whatever it may be. You can become totally self-sufficient. You can live largely independently of the utility and make your own decisions about what you're going to do in a way that you can't really do in a fossil fuel economy. Yeah, there are just stacks and stacks of new battery designs. And partly it's to make them more efficient, to make the manufacturing process more efficient. And partly it's to avoid using copious quantities of materials where there could be supply chain issues. So lithium, for example, is one where deposits are not super abundant in the world. copper is another thing. You need copper for wiring and stuff as well. So do you want that? What about cobalt? So some manufacturers have deliberately tried to steer away from those materials. One of the ironies about it is that if you are a free market advocate and you just love capitalist competition, you should be totally enamored of what's happening in the battery world. It's the best example I can think of in any industry where you've got innovation, competition, and just improvement of products as a result. So it's an exciting place to look, I think. It's actually true, but I guess no one needs AI in the same way that we need oil or we need food. So I think from that point of view, it's a lot easier. No, for me, I find AI fascinating, slightly scary. And I find that the amount of discussion of setting it off in a carefully thought through direction is way lower than the amount of fascination with the latest thing that it can actually do. Often fiction should be our guide to these things, or can be a valuable guide to these things. Well, journalism is really about telling stories. And the sort of pinnacle of journalism, I think, is where you can take something that's serious and important and impactful, and you can put it in a form that will engage people. This is really the secret of it. And yeah, I grew up, as you mentioned, in radio, and really brilliant speech radio is eavesdropping on a conversation where someone is telling the story about something full. And I think in this field of energy and climate change, the contrarians have got the easy job because the ingredients of their stories resonate. So it won't work. It's going to cost too much. They're trying to make you have something that you don't want. Let's stick with the old ways, the ones that we know are safe. As opposed to, this can work, and here's an explanation of how it can work. And yes, it may be more expensive, but we know the price is going to come down because of X, Y, Z. I would like young people to have the sort of growing up experience that allows them to be children as long as they need to be children. It's a very pure way of looking at the world. And I think that childhoods now have become a little bit compressed. By the time it's a good idea for a child to have a mobile phone, then that's already stuff that's coming into their life that can be a pressure. So I just want them to have the freedom to grow up, basically, as kids, and just not be forced into a sort of early adult. A lot of the biggest insights I've ever had in any parts of my life have come from literature. Literature takes the world and looks at it through a certain window and tells the story in a way that you might not have thought of doing it yourself. And so by engaging in it, you just get richer, I think, in terms of the way that you look at the world yourself.
We hope you've enjoyed this program and listening to the highlights of this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast or learn more about environmental projects, click on the subscribe button. Thank you for listening.